evening, everyone, and a very warm welcome from Miracle Hour. This is John Campbell welcoming all our listeners all over the world for another interesting evening with one of my guests. It's been a hectic couple of weeks. I've just recently come back from San Francisco myself, and I just want to start our program tonight by offering our blessings to Don, our program presenter, program creator, coordinator, whose mother transited last week, and he was able to be there. So our thoughts and blessings are with you, Don, and your family. And tonight, my guest is somebody who I came across pretty early on my journey of awakening, and I think it was at a workshop in London. His name is Nick Williams, and he's done some amazing work and continues to do so. He's a trustee of the Alternatives organization in London, where they have wonderful speakers and workshops at the beautiful St. James's Church in London. He's a trustee and director of Alternatives, and he's an author of some amazing books, The Work We Were Born to Do being one of the first ones I read, and a number of others. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you on the show tonight, Nick, and I hope you're hearing us okay.
I can hear you fine, thank you, yeah. Really looking forward to this, so thank you for having me on.
Yeah, you're welcome. So, Nick, what I do with most of my guests is pretty much the same format. It's, you know, it's always a fascinating thing, I think, to find how people kind of change their path in life to one which is something of a more deeper purpose, etc., and how that comes about. Everyone's story is unique and interesting, so I wanted to know if you could, please, to start with, let us know a little bit about your background, you know, where you grew up, and all that kind of stuff leading into, you know, how you got into this wonderful journey that we're all on.
Thank you. Well, I suppose, you know, in many respects, I'd call my upbringing normal. I, you know, went to school and did all the normal things and did exams, and I guess, you know, perhaps a lot of people can relate to this, but I think as a kid, I always thought, you know, and probably the expression that I would use is, you know, I wanted to be about my father's business. You know, it's like I wanted to do something that had some meaning and some purpose to it. But when I looked around at the world, I thought, well, you know, nobody else seems to be doing that. Everybody else seems to just have jobs and live normal lives. So maybe I just better pretend that I just want to have a job and a normal life. So I tried to hang out and be normal for many years and do what normal people do.
Great way to put it.
Yeah, thank you. And so, you know, I did a degree in business studies, and then I went off and got a job in sales and marketing. And in my early 20s, you know, I thought, yeah, you know, I'm a young guy, I want to be successful. And to me, success meant, you know, money and a nice job in the City of London selling computers to Japanese banks and kind of working hard and playing hard. And kind of enjoyed it for a couple of years, you know, it's kind of a young man's thing, and I enjoyed it. But I think, you know, what I was trying to do, looking back on it, was I was trying to succeed myself away from, you know, actually believing I was a bit of a failure, really. And it's funny because as I was thinking about, you know, what we might talk about tonight, I was thinking, well, most people don't come at their spiritual paths from joy, usually. Most people come from some form of suffering. You know, and most of our stories have a, you know, I was so miserable, I thought there must be another way, and that's when I started. You know, opening A Course in Miracles or going on Zen Buddhist retreats. Yeah. So, you know, in some respects, my story is typical of that, which is, you know, by my late 20s, I was successful on the outside and feeling like an utter success and miserable on the inside. So so that's when my kind of spiritual journey, I suppose, reawoke, because I think perhaps we all have it when we're children, but I tried to put it to one side, and I didn't neglect that whole kind of spiritual creative side of myself until I was in my late 20s.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. I love the way that Hafiz, I think it was Hafiz, the Sufi poet, did he say something about, you know, in the end we only have two choices, we either come to God dressed for dancing or we get wheeled into God's ward on a stretcher.
I think most of us need to be broken open,
like
rather
you
than
came in a wheelchair.
Yeah, well, and on the outside I looked all right, but on the inside, you know, you needed an inner wheelchair, I think.
Yeah.
But I think that's often the challenge for many of us, because, you know, often people will look at our lives and go, well, you seem to have got it together, you know, you've got everything that should make you happy. And I think that's often what we struggle with, and certainly I struggled with, was, well, how come I'm not happy? I've got everything I thought would make me happy.
Yeah, yeah. So this So were you in your early 20s at this time?
By now, this is my late 20s, you know, and I had one of those kind of, you know, I probably had two road to Damascus moments, you know, when I was in computer sales and marketing, and one of my moments was actually winning a trip to Antigua, which sounds wonderful, and it was wonderful because I'd sold a lot of computers, and, you know, I was very grateful to have gone, but, you know, I was on the beach in Antigua with a beer in my hand and utterly miserable, thinking, I just don't want to go home. You know, I just want to stay here. You know, this seems to be such a high cost to this thing called success that I've been chasing after for so long. So I think at that point, you know, I thought something's got to change. So then I went into another job and that was less high pressure. But then I think, you know, my other pivotal moment was when, anybody who knows London knows the embankment very close to Waterloo Bridge. And I was walking from my office just to get some air and get out of the office because I was so miserable. And this, I was walking through Embankment Gardens and somebody behind me said, "Cheer up, mate." And I looked round and it was this tramp, this homeless guy, was telling me to cheer up. I had my suit on and my tie and I'm, you know, leaving my high-powered job and stuff, and he was telling me to cheer up, and I thought, hang on, you know, this is a sign here. Yeah, something's not right.
Where did that lead you then from there, Nick? I mean, did you start, often people find a book, don't they? A book drops into their lap.
Yeah, but I think what opened me up, I'm just slightly hesitating because I've got a bit of distortion on the line. I don't know if there's anything we can do about it. There's a slight bit of distortion I'm hearing. I got into kind of personal growth, really, for my own benefit to start with. And the first thing I got involved with was something called transactional analysis. I don't know if you've heard of it. But it's a kind of, you know, most people would probably call it pop psychology. And in some ways it probably is, but I actually found it immensely helpful at that point in my life to help me make sense of the upbringing that I'd had and why I felt like I felt and, you know, all those things. So I got into some counseling and therapy for myself to start with, and perhaps like many people that get into any kind of, you know, personal healing or whatever, they think to themselves, well, I want to help other people, you know, this is helping me so much, I want to help everybody else, and I'm afraid I just never grew out of that, and I'm still doing it today, and I've turned it into my career and my living, if you like.
And did you, you went into therapy using TA?
Yeah, to start with, you know, that was probably just over 20 years ago now, so I'm a slow learner, or maybe there's just a lot to undo. I went into it for my own kind of interest and growth to start with, and then thought, you know, but I'd love to help other people in the way that I seem to be being helped here. And that also then after a while led me, I suppose, into spirituality. And I guess for a lot of people, you know, maybe their kind of journey, like mine, goes from psychology to spirituality because they realize
that
psychology, only has, you know, some of the answers. You know, and in a way, psychology to me is, you know, you just want to undo stuff so that your spirit can shine through. And I guess that's you know, how I see psychology. It's just an unbelievable
process. Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. And yeah, I think you're right that everybody's on a search for God from the moment they're born, you know, the moment they come
I don't think we're going to find the answers in psychology. I think we only find the answers in spirituality.
Well, I agree with that totally, you know. And I think the other thing is that what you said about, you know, once you get into this, there's almost a given that you want to go out and give it away and help others as well.
I see that as part of, you know, the more we connect to our own heart, I think, you know, our own heart wants to extend outwards. You know, if we've found something precious, it's like you don't look at a sunset and then go, nobody look at the sunset, it's my sunset. You know, it's like we find something precious and we want to share it.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm always concerned about becoming an evangelist about anything, but, you know, I honestly want to share whatever has helped me with other people, and really that's what I've made my career out of, is just, you know, pioneering in my own life and then saying, well, this is what I found works for me, and might it help you?
Well, it is. I think it is one of the first books that I read when I was at college, when I got out of the corporate world, which was exactly what happened with John Cleese, you know, who had got into therapy himself and was so completely blown away by what he'd learned about himself that he thought, well, why the heck doesn't everyone get to understand this, that unless you sort of go into therapy or you go to train to be a therapist. So that's when he joined up with his with his therapist, Robin Skinner, and wrote
yeah,
the book
yeah.
Families and How to Survive Them.
Yeah,
that came
I remember.
From a real desire to, you know, get it out there, because with his name, and I think that book did a lot for people, because people who related to him as a comedian, you know,
yeah.
were able to get some of that information. So I know exactly, I totally agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, I remember reading that book, and I remember one of my angry moments after probably a therapy session, I remember buying a copy and throwing it at my mum and dad as well, and saying, you need it. And
yeah,
they didn't appreciate it.
That's another common thing that's very easy to get into, isn't it? Once we've tasted this, we want everybody to have a piece of it, you know.
Yeah. We want to blame them and say, you should have read this before you had me, you know.
So you got into this then. You got into your therapy with TA, and where did that lead you? Were you still working in the corporate world at that time?
Yeah, at that stage, that was about 1986, and I was kind of easing my way out of the corporate world, but really not knowing exactly what I did want to do. I'd started giving a few kind of just talks in the TA world, and, you know, I found that I just loved, I felt it was my purpose to help kind of inspire people and maybe teach them in some way. But, you know, I grew up in Essex, you know, for those of you that don't know the UK, you know, the county of Essex has a kind of reputation for being, you know, not the most high quality and high energy of places, and I was born in Essex. You know, and every time I thought to myself, well, you know, I'd love to do something spiritual, I'd love to inspire people, I'd love to teach people, you know, I'd love to be creative, and maybe there's even a book in me, you know, and I'd have that thought for about 20 seconds, and then all these voices in my head would go, but who the blooming heck do you think you are? You know, you're just a computer salesman from Essex, get back in your box, you know, and so I had a kind of dim sense of what I wanted to do, but my resistance to it and my, you know, my own inertia and my own, you know, undermining and self-sabotage were phenomenal, you know. So it took me a number of years to actually muster the courage to say, I'm going to follow this voice rather than actually, you know, run away from it and try and squash it.
Yeah, you mean you were going to follow the spirit party that was telling you to go out and do this
yeah.
stuff and ignore the other
one? Yeah, you know, and I kind of joke with people, but I think there's some truth in that. You know, at that point in my life, I probably had 5% inspiration, 5% self-belief, and 5% self-confidence, and 85% fear, doubt, and anxiety. But, you know, in retrospect, that was all I needed.
This is a great role model, Nick, for other people out there. Because, I mean, it's very easy, isn't it, to think that people that have got it and they've written books and done workshops and been on TV or radio or whatever, that they don't have any of these fears. And of course, it's so nice when people
yeah.
have courage like you have to talk about it.
Thank you. Well, you know, that's one of the things I kind of want to do in a way, is kind of bust the myth that successful people, and, you know, I don't necessarily count myself as the most successful person, but I think one of the ways that people that feel stuck in their life, you know, stay stuck, is they say, well, you know, successful people obviously don't suffer like I do, and they don't have the same fears and doubts and, you know, lack of confidence that I do, because look at what they've done. You know, and I want to be as honest as I can about my own journey whilst not undermining myself by playing smaller than I can do, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So I guess my, you know, underlying purpose for everything is really to be as authentic as I can be and talk about my strengths and my talents and my abilities, but also my fears and my doubts and my vulnerabilities, you know, which most of us have plenty.
Yeah. So carry on with where you were.
Yeah,
what happened?
So at that point I began, you know, I probably became a bit of a personal development junkie for a while and just went on lots of different workshops and stuff and, you know, was probably in my honeymoon phase of, you know, self-discovery of thinking everything's wonderful. Why didn't somebody tell me this when I was growing up? And I heard about something called Alternatives at St. James's that was just starting up. There was actually a program called Turning Points that was already running, but it was closing down and being reopened. And I went along to that, and I kind of got involved as a team member. And for Alternatives, for people that don't know it, you can look up their website. It's a not-for-profit organization that's now been going for 25 years in two different forms. It's alternatives.org.uk, and it's probably the UK's premier.
Alternatives.org.uk?
Yeah, and it's probably the UK's premier kind of, you know, mind, body, spirit platform. And it, as you said earlier, it happens in this wonderful church in Piccadilly that... Sir Christopher Wren designed, and apparently it was one of his favourite churches, and William Blake was baptised at the back of the church in a font, which is still there. So it's a quite a magical place, and it's got a real history of...
If any of our listeners haven't been there, I mean, it's really worth a visit. If you're visiting London, it's just like Nick said, it's a very special place.
And it's quite unique in as much as it is a functioning Christian church, which, you know, still holds Sunday services and all sorts of different things, but has quite a radical heart and is very welcoming of other spiritualities and also very welcoming of people with no particular spiritual faith. So there's lots of interfaith dialogues go on there, which is very exciting. Plus, they hold a very warm welcome for us as, I suppose you'd call us in a way, New Ages, although I hate the idea of, you know, the word New Ages, but, you know, we're kind of eclectic spiritual people, and, you know, one night we might have a shaman, the next we might have a Catholic priest, the next we might have a Qigong practitioner, the next we might have a psychotherapist, and, you know, we love the diversity of what we put on, and also we're very grateful to the church for having the kind of broadness of mind and spirit to allow us to do it, you know, in that setting, and not just tolerate us, but actually actively welcome us and see us as part of their community. And I think that takes a lot of courage.
And is that down to the particular pastor of the church, Chris?
It was, there was a guy called Donald Reeves who, you know, he's not there anymore, not at the church. He now does his own thing and is doing amazing stuff in Bosnia and helping reconstruction there and healing happen there. But he took over the church, I'm guessing, in the early 80s, probably, so about 25 years ago. And when he took over the church as rector, you know, I think he described Sunday services, there was, you know, 20 people in the audience and a dog. You know, and they'd all been going there for years and they were all quite old. And by about his second or third week there and his sermon, you know, they were down to about two people and the dog had gone as well, I think. You know, the place was dying on its feet, you know, from a Christian perspective. But he had a very radical heart, and he is a very strong Christian, and he remains a Christian, but he also wanted to open up the church to homeless people, to the New Age, to alternative spirituality, to concerts, all sorts of amazing things he did. And we were one of the things that he welcomed, and so he had a very, very big heart and welcomed us in, but he retired about 8 or 9 years ago now, and there was a new rector coming in, and we were a bit concerned because we thought, well, maybe the new rector isn't going to be as welcoming as the old one, and maybe we won't have a home anymore. So I was still involved on a kind of operational level when the new rector took over, and I went out for tea with him one day, and I was a bit anxious, and I said to him, well, you know, what's your view on what we do? And I loved his response. He said, God works in mysterious ways, and alternatives is one of them.
Oh, that's really cool. That's lovely.
Yeah.
A nice way to put it.
Yeah, so you know, we have actually probably got the strongest relationship we've ever had with the church, and we're a kind of integral part of the church. And I think the truth is, you know, probably we often bring in more people on a Monday night to the church than maybe they get on a Sunday to the service. So
in a way, we are
part of the life of the church.
Absolutely. I mean, I have memories of many, many talks that I've been to up there and queuing all the way down. What road is that that runs there?
Piccadilly.
That's Piccadilly, yeah.
Yeah.
Being way and looking way up, thinking, oh, am I ever going to get in there, you know?
Yeah. It's amazing.
Is that rector still there, Nick?
Sorry?
Is that the same rector that's there now?
No, his name's Charles now, the rector now. Donald left, as I say, about 8 or 9 years ago, but now Charles is the rector. And
it's the same one who took over.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, he's been there for 8 or 9 years, and he's going to be there for the foreseeable future, I think, yeah.
And do alternatives have a talk every Monday, is it?
Other than August, yeah, when we take a month off, and... sometimes when it's a bank holiday, we don't have a talk. We might miss a week, or we put it on another day of the week. So we probably put on 45 to 50 talks a year. Most of them will be in St. James's. A few of them will be off-site. So for many people, you know, I remember when I started going there, it was a big thing for me just to go into a church, let alone into a church and then talk about alternative spirituality, you know. I felt like I was going to be burnt at the stake for it for, you know, quite a few years of going there.
You probably were at one time.
Yeah. Yeah, the witch burning was still alive in my mind, you know.
Yeah. So this was something you started to do again while you were still sort of finding your feet.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, in a way, you know, it was so important to me because I didn't have a home for my spirit, if you like. You know, I didn't have a spiritual home, you know, because I'd rejected the church, as probably so many of us do. And yet, you know, I knew on one level I'd thrown out the baby with the bathwater. So for me, it was just so wonderful to be able to go into this kind of non-denominational, welcoming space of spirituality where, you know, there was no prescription of what I must think or believe or have faith in or rules to follow. So it was wonderful. And, it was a space, I suppose, you know, like a, I suppose the image I would have would be like parched blotting paper. You know, my soul was parched, and going there, it was like, you know, I suddenly began to drink it all up and become like a, you know, it was like an oasis for me, and you know, just help me rejuvenate my own soul by being able to go there and listen to the likes of, you know, Deepak Chopra and Marianne Williamson and Eckhart Tolle, you know, not 20 years ago, but you know, these days we'll put on Eckhart Tolle or Byron Katie, and just to be able to listen to these people, for me, was just, it was like, you know, something inside me came back to life by listening to these other people, and it was just so precious and so important to me to be involved with that. And I'm a great believer that all of us need to know, you know, what our wells of inspiration are and go to them regularly. And for me at that point in my life, Alternatives was, you know, such a valuable well that I just wanted to go to and, you know, soak myself in.
Yeah. And were you living in London at the time?
Yeah. I lived in and around London. So, but then I kind of got more and more involved, and in a way, being involved with Alternatives gave me the courage then to leave the corporate world, because I realized there was somewhere else I did belong, you know, other than the corporate world.
Yeah. But the biggest thing, I think, which so many of us have to face, the ones that come from the corporate world, is that massive, you know, the big M, I call it, the big money M, you know, is where's the money going to come from? You know, we come from this kind of, you know, sort of fixed salary type with commissions and all the rest of whatever, and it becomes so much a part of us, doesn't it, that, you know, and often it's quite in large sums, especially sometimes, you know.
So
it's quite a scary thing, I know it was for me, to turn back on that.
Yeah, massively. Yeah, you know, and this is one of the things I talk about today, is, you know, I think most of us grow up with one of two beliefs, and first belief is that, you know, if you want to earn a reasonable living in this world, or even just sustain yourself to some extent, you have to kind of sell out on your own soul and do something that you don't particularly enjoy. Or the other extreme is you can do something spiritual and holy and creative that you really value and has meaning for you, but you should give up all hope of ever earning any money doing it. So, you know, I think it's this kind of fundamental ego belief in sacrifice, and the ego says you've got to sacrifice. You've either got to sacrifice the love for the money or the money for the love, because you certainly can't have both. And I think it's taken me a long time to realize that both I can have and how to have both, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, spirituality and poverty for many people go together in their minds, or, you know, corporate spiritless life with a load of money that compensates you for not enjoying it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think what's important, that I had to go through the same sort of confusion, you know. I mean, I remember I came out, you know, I sold my big car, I did everything. I thought I had to become a pauper, you know. And I think the thing that I eventually had to come to learn was that there's absolutely nothing wrong with my money's actually neutral. You know, it's the energy we put onto it. But also not to spiritualize it, because spirit is spirit, and anything which is in form is not spirit, if you like. But it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with it.
No. You know, I'm a student of A Course in Miracles, and, you know, from that I've learned in a way that, you know, nothing, you know, yes, as you say, nothing material really has any meaning in its own right. It's really the consciousness we bring to it. So, you know, money can be used for very unholy purposes. Money can be used for very holy purposes, and everywhere in between. So, you know, I suppose the word I would use is let money be innocent, and develop the consciousness, you know, around money that would really be helpful around it.
That's fantastic. Well, I'd like to expand on the, you know, getting to the Course in Miracles, but I would imagine that's a bit further down the road from where we are at the moment with your story, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. I think, you know, how I came to A Course in Miracles was, if I look back on it, I was probably more of a self-improvement junkie than I was a spiritual junkie, if you like, you know.
Yeah.
And I think my belief at that point in my life, and this is probably 15, 20 years ago, was, you know, if only I could eliminate these negative aspects of myself, and if only I could you know, become really successful, then I'd feel okay about myself. And, you know, however hard I tried and however many workshops I went on, I never seemed to be able to get rid of these negative aspects of myself. You know, I could still be miserable, I could still be depressed, I could still be angry, and I thought, well, how many more workshops have I got to go on before I get rid of all these, you know, traits that I don't like in myself? And I think when I stumbled across A Course in Miracles, firstly, I didn't understand it, but secondly, you know, I think sometimes we need a good teacher of it to bring us to life.
Oh, absolutely.
And about 12 or 13 years ago, I met, I don't know if you know, do you know Tom and Linda Carpenter? Have you ever met them?
No, I mean, I know their names, obviously, being a student of the course now, a serious student of the course now. I've known their names. I haven't actually met with them. I've heard wonderful things about them. They're based in the States, aren't they?
They've got a home in Seattle, and they live part of the year in Hawaii as well. And I met them through Robert Miranda Holden originally, probably about 12 or 13 years ago. And, you know, I remember just being in Tom's presence particularly, and him just looking at me, and he says, he just looked me in the eyes, and he said, Nick, there's nothing wrong with you. And I think it was the first time in my life anyone had ever said that to me, or anybody had said it to me in a way that I really started to believe it. And he said, stop trying to improve yourself, accept that you are okay. And I think at that point in my life, you know, that conversation I had when I first met him was when I realized that the path of self-improvement was never going to lead me to happiness, that the path of self-acceptance was the only one that was going to lead me to happiness. And it wasn't about trying to eliminate any aspects of myself, but it was about loving and accepting all aspects of myself, you know, my humanness, my ego, my, you know, vulnerabilities, as well as my spiritual strengths and talents and gifts. So for me, you know, Tom as the embodiment of A Course in Miracles, or teacher of A Course in Miracles, was probably initially more important than the book, because I needed somebody to look me in the eyes and say it to me, not me just to read it, you know.
Right, yeah. So did you come across them? How did that happen? I mean, did you come across the book, first of all?
I don't know. I think just on my spiritual path, you know, it was always there in kind of peripheral vision. But then I picked it up and probably like most people thought, you know, but this doesn't make sense to me, or it sounds too Christian. I don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, there's too much about the Bible, I thought.
Yeah. So, you know, we've probably all got stories of people that we know put it on the bookshelf for years and never read it. And I think probably the second thing that really opened me up to it was, I think probably first reading, you know, A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson, and then actually having her to talk at Alternatives in London and meeting her and really feeling like, you know, again, she's an embodiment of it. I begin to get what it's about. And in a way, she then inspired me to start reading A Course in Miracles. So I think it was after I first met her and heard her speak that I began to open A Course in Miracles and do the lessons.
So then you went out and you got the book and actually started to read it in earnest and start doing the workbook.
Yeah. But I'm still very kind of shy and embarrassed about it in a way. You know, I remember many years ago being, you know Ian Patrick, obviously, don't you? Because he was on last week, was he? The week before?
Yes, he was last week.
Yeah. I remember Ian just at one of the Miracles conferences in London many years ago, probably about 13 years ago, said to me, you know, would I read a couple of things from the Course in Miracles at the conference? So he didn't even want me to give a talk. He just wanted me to kind of read a little bit. I was terrified, you know. I couldn't believe the level of fear in me, even just reading some of the things that it said in there. It really, I don't know why, but it engendered a lot of fear in me. It's almost like fear of owning my spirituality, or fear of acknowledging my spirituality. Like, you know, something terrible was going to happen if I said that I was spiritual.
Yeah. So then you started to study that in earnest, and did that correspond to when you started to go out and do talks of your own,
I'll talk about a part of my journey which I think a lot of people may be able to resonate with, and I think it's, you know, it's so important that, you know, I love talking about this because I think so many of us get caught on is. You know, I love being involved in the world of personal and spiritual development for many years. And what I found after a few years of being involved with alternatives was I began to, you know, I suppose if I'm honest, even begin to get a bit critical of people and kind of sit there and listen to their talks and go, you know, I could say that as well as they do. You know, I've heard that many times before. You know, they're not saying anything different to what I'd heard already. So part of me was a bit critical and a bit judgmental. And then I think it's probably about 10 years ago, I went on holiday. Probably about 10 or 11 years ago, I went on holiday and I took a copy of The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron with me. And I wanted to collect the quotes because I'm a voracious collector of quotations and wisdom. I just love doing it. I've probably got about 10,000 quotes I've collected over the years. And I took it on holiday just initially to read through and pick out the quotes and put them on my laptop. But then I started reading the book, and I had what I... Am I allowed to say a slight swear word on here?
Oh, yes, I'm sure, yeah. Go ahead.
I'm a great believer that we should have what I call oh shit moments in our lives from time to time. And when I was reading the Artist's Way, I had one of my oh shit moments. And she was talking about the shadow artist. And the shadow artist is somebody who's kind of creatively involved in the area that they want to become involved in, but they're afraid to put their own creativity right at the center of their life. And when I read that, part of me went, oh my God, you know, here I am immersed in the world of personal and spiritual development, but instead of me being the one talking, I'm putting on everybody else for talks. And in that moment, I had one of those kind of aha moments where I went, I'm the one who wants to be giving the talks. I'm the one who wants to be teaching. I want to be out front. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was inspired for about 30 seconds, and then the part of me went, you know, but who the hell am I to think that anybody would ever want to listen to me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so... You know, again, that resistance just kicked in majorly. But I think, again, in that moment, I realized, you know, yes, I love the world of personal and spiritual development, but actually I was also a teacher, not just an organizer. Wonderful as it was to meet all these great people and to know that I was part of helping, you know, consciousness change, I felt I had a bigger game to play. You know, what the Course in Miracles would probably call my grandeur was calling to me.
Yeah, you know, rather than grandiosity. Big difference.
That's right, you know, and for 30 seconds I thought it was my grandeur, and then for the rest of the time I thought it was my grandiosity.
Yes,
you know, and I think, you know, one of the big paradoxes is sometimes, you know, our ego takes hold of our grandeur and calls it grandiose. So it's almost like we can't win, you know, to think there's grandeur in us, our ego will tell us it's being grandiose.
Exactly, Well, that's interesting because that's, and also there are some... you know, it's like everything, you know, some things are not quite as clear as others, and there are some movements out there that would actually encourage you to think that as well, you know, and that's what I had to watch out for, you know. I had to really keep close to the principles that, you know, of the spirit, which is perfect, whole, and complete, and know that it's not grandiose to believe that.
Yeah, you know, because I think... You know, most, well, no, I could make an overgeneralization, which is probably not true, but so many religions and teachings say that we're basically miserable sinners that one day can be saved.
Yeah.
You know, and that we're bad and guilty and evil, but, you know, one day somebody might save us. And to think too highly of ourselves, you know, for many of us is just, you know, like I said, for me it was really scary to think highly of myself. You know, and perhaps that's where, of course, you know, the Course helped me in my life to realize that that was actually the truth. It wasn't my own arrogance.
And
to me, that's what I love about the Course, you know. If it's true, which I assume it is true, then, God, what a wonderful message. You know, we're
absolutely
amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
What a relief.
So you then switch from being a presenter of people to going out and doing your own talk.
Well,
where
slowly,
did you first off?
Slowly, you know, I was already doing some of that. You know, I was giving some talks and some workshops, but my major kind of activity and energy and to some extent income was around organizing other people's talks.
Yeah.
And to be honest, that's probably when I really started writing as well, articles to start with, and then what became my first book. So, you know, that was another of those pivotal moments where I realized, you know, there was more in me to come out than I was allowing to come out. And you know, I suppose I must have made a conscious choice there to say, you know, I'm not going to play small. I'm going to, you know, find out what is in me and bring that out to the best of my ability and share it myself with people.
Yeah. What was your first breakthrough with regarding the writing, Nick? Because that's a big step, you know, that I've just taken myself. Mm. And I've come to realize that, you know, nobody writes a book on their own.
No.
You know, it's always a collaboration, isn't it? And I've found such a difference now that I've got, you know, somebody I'm working with, you know. And did you find that quite quickly, or did you already have that sort of team around you?
I suppose, talking about kind of oh shit moments, you know, probably another oh shit moment for me was when, you know, because I was involved with alternatives, you know, we dealt a lot with the major mind, body, spirit publishers because they always had authors that they would suggest for speeches, you know, and talks. So when it came to me beginning to write, you know, I knew who to talk to. I didn't necessarily know these people very well, but I knew who to talk to. So I probably sent out a book proposal to half a dozen of them. And one came back to me and said, we really like the sound of this. We'd like you to write the book and we'd like to give you a contract. And for me, it was like, again, one of those kind of oh shit moments where it's like, oh my goodness, they're taking me too seriously. You know, I only wanted them to want me to write the book. I didn't want to actually have to write it. Can I do it?
Yeah.
So again, you know, I went through major kind of self-questioning and self-doubt and thinking, you know, am I just on an ego trip or is it part of my purpose to write this book? So, you know, I had the contract and then I did a meditation or a prayer really and just, you know, talked to God or talked to my own soul and said, you know, is it right for me to write this book? You know, and it was almost like my soul was shouting at me saying, for goodness sake, just get on and write the bloody thing, you know.
And this is the work we were born to do, is it?
Yeah, and this is the first one, the work we were born to do. And
right.
So, you know, in that moment, really, I just made a commitment to write it. And I think I probably learned a major lesson around commitment because, you know, I've not been brilliant at commitment in my life. You know, it's like, well, when things turn out, then maybe I'll commit to them. You know, it's like I wanted the guarantee to go with things before I'd make any commitments. And and I realized that I needed to commit to writing the book before I'd done it, if you know what I mean. So, because I felt such an inner pull to do it, and because my guidance was saying, get on and do it, you know, I signed the contract, I sent it back, and I only had 3 months to write it, and it was quite a big book in the end. But I must admit, it was like the doors to inspiration flew open by me committing to writing the book.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, I had an inner opening in that moment of signing the contract and sending it back and saying, I will write this book. And it feels like that door opened and it's never closed again. And that was probably, 10, 11 years ago now.
That's wonderful. Yeah. And who did you get to publish the first one?
Element Books were my publisher, who were a large independent publisher. You know, and it was great, and they did a good job to start with. And unfortunately, about a year after my book came out, they went into receivership and went out of business. And I suppose, luckily and unluckily, I ended up with Thorsons, who are part of HarperCollins, who republished it. And I'm pleased to say, which is quite unusual for a book these days, you know, it came out in 1999. It's been out for 9 years, and it's still in print. You know, it's not selling massively anymore, but you know, to have I think 90% of books go out of print in the first year because they just don't sell enough. So I'm very honoured and thrilled that something I wrote, you know, has had an impact.
Oh, it's a wonderful achievement. It really is.
Thank you.
Because I was thinking that I must have come to probably one of your early workshops, and I remember the one it was on abundance and using the abundance book, you know, John Randolph Price.
Oh, yeah, John...
up in London.
John Randolph Price.
Yeah, wonderful little book. That was a fantastic book when I found that.
Yeah.
And that was up in London.
Yeah.
So that would have been about 9 years ago now, 10 years ago maybe.
Yeah. So that's probably just when my first book was coming out. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, to me, being an author has been a great, great blessing. You know, I love the creative act of writing. To me, you know, in some ways, I probably never feel closer to God than when I'm actually writing.
And tell me, if you would, a little bit, and share with our listeners about how did you go about that? I mean, you'd obviously, I presume, I'm making an assumption here that you'd never done any courses in writing, you'd never been trained as a writer, you haven't got a degree in English, presumably.
No, you know, and
so. And what form did it take? How often did you do it? How long did you do it in one stretch? I'm really eager to hear that.
Because I was already giving talks and workshops around this subject, you know, I feel like I was serving an apprenticeship, and I certainly find a lot of people that say, well, I want to write a book, and then when I've written the book, I go out and give the talks and the workshops on the subject. And I would certainly counsel people to do it the other way around. You know, if you feel called to do something, if you've got a message that you think people really can benefit from, get out and do it. Don't wait until you've written a book. Because I think my book was very rich because I'd actually been out there talking about it for years anyway, and doing my own work. So I'd heard most of the kind of questions that people had, most of their fears, most of their concerns. So when I came to write the book, I felt in a way I was really consolidating everything I'd learned up until that point. And I suppose it wasn't just about but the work that I was doing. You know, I threw in a lot of other wisdom that I'd learned through all the people that I'd met through alternatives. And, you know, in a way, you know, I think I wrote it when I was about 39 or 40. So it was almost like drawing a line under everything I'd learned about kind of personal and spiritual growth up to that point in my life. So I packed a lot in. And, you know, I've touched on it already, but I think, you know, what I've learned over the years is that the closer you do get to whatever your kind of life purpose or your soul purpose is in this life, you know, your calling, the more more resistance you are likely to hit. You know, so
so let me just clarify. Are you saying that, which is what I noticed as well, the closer you are to really doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're going to have lots of kind of ego coming in and giving you all sorts of blockages and sabotaging.
Your ego will kick in big time. You know, I've always known that, and I've kind of dealt with it, but just another little tip for everybody listening, if they haven't read it yet, there's a wonderful, wonderful book called The War of Art, not The Art of War, but The War of Art, by a guy called Stephen Pressfield. He's a fiction writer, but he wrote this book about, you know, how when you want to be creative, you're going to have to deal with your own resistance. And when I read the book about 3 or 4 years ago, I knew within the first 3 pages or so that this was a book that was going to change my life. And it really helped me understand a lot about my life. And it's something that I teach a lot about now, because obviously I teach people how to find their own calling and their purpose. But almost the second most important thing I teach them is how to recognize and overcome their own resistance to it. Because, you know, if you want to be creative and inspired and spiritual, you better learn how to recognize resistance and overcome it, because they're going to be twin souls on your journey.
You
know, twin forces.
Well, it is true as well. I mean, also anything which is going to take you to the truth, if you like, you know, the truth of who you really are. I mean, I've heard amazing stories of people going to do massive healing workshops, you know, and as you know, I'm a great supporter of something called the Hoffman Process, which was my first entry into really touching who I really was, and many people say the same. And the number of stories of people going on their way, going down there in you know, quite functioning cars, quite new cars, and the cars would suddenly inexplicably break down, and well, they'd lose their way, and this would happen, all sorts of, all manner of things. It's quite incredible.
It's amazing what we use to manifest our resistance, as you say. You know, it can be computers, cars, other people, all sorts of things. So I did hit a lot of resistance, and you know, and I'll share one of the biggest ones about writing, and I'm sure most people can relate to this if they've ever tried to write or have written. You know, when I sat down and started thinking about writing a book, part of me was going, but who'd want to listen to me? You know, if I'm going to talk about overcoming fear, why don't they just go and buy Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway by Susan Jeffers? If I'm going to talk about A Course in Miracles, why don't they just buy A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson? You know, why have I got anything to add to this? Who am I to have any value to add? And I think that's just one of the very subtle and insidious ways that resistance works is, you know, it tries to undermine us and say, well, you're nobody special. Who do you think you are? Nobody's going to want to listen to you. So my way through it was to think, well, you know, I do believe I have an authentic voice. I do think I have something to say. But I think probably what I've discovered to be the most important thing is not to think that I have to be totally original and say anything that's never been said before, but to say what's my personal truth, and to some extent will be spiritual and eternal truths, but say them in my own authentic way, based on my own life experience. Yeah. So for me, the goal is not originality now. The goal is authenticity. And I'm a great believer that, you know, if it's coming from our heart and we're being authentic, somebody needs to hear it, and there'll be a market for it out there.
That's wonderful that you put that out there, because that's so true. That is absolutely so true. I mean, it was quite early on that I realised that there is very little original stuff there, and that doesn't matter. It's original in a different way. It's original because it's coming from you, or it's coming from the next person. So it's their original form, but underlying it, the message is universal.
Yeah, you know, when I look back on it, you know, I think, well, you know, in a way, the work we were born to do, the first book, you know, I'm not the first person ever to have written about callings. You know, people have been talking about calling and vocation for thousands of years, but I've just talked about it in a way that's real and authentic for me and is contemporary and relevant to so many people today. So a lot of people can relate to that. And secondly, I kind of come at it because, you know, people say, well, I want to write about overcoming fear, but Susan Jeffers beat me to it 20 years ago when she wrote, you know, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And my answer to them is, well, yeah, she's probably done very well, and maybe she sold 5 million copies, but on a big planet, that means there's 5,995,000,000 people that still haven't read her book. So it's a pretty big market that's left for you.
That's so good. That's such an inspiration. And Nick, did you have somebody, you know, because what I've recognized, I don't know whether you can identify, one of my big panels, I had to do it alone. Like, there was never anybody there for me, so I had to be alone, you know. So reaching out has always been a really big thing for me. Now, did you have somebody to, and then when I started to do that, I realized what a difference it made. So did you have sort of like a mentor or somebody to walk you through these early, you know, challenges?
Not before I was actually writing and published, no. You know, in a way, I just did it, which, well, you know, for me, that may well have been a manifestation of what you say, which is I didn't ask for help, but at that point, perhaps I didn't need it as much. I just needed to write. But certainly when I came to getting a contract, you know, I did have a hands-on editor who helped me with the editing process. And for me, that was a major kind of learning thing, to trust somebody to actually help me. You know, because I probably overwrote the book by about a third, and so when I took it in to hand it in, she said, well, you know, it's great, but we'll need to do some editing, so could you, you know, shave, you know, a third of the words out? No, actually, I can't. You know, for me, at that point in my life, it was the most amazing thing for me to learn to written. I didn't know anything about editing. So I basically asked her, I said, well, you know, would you do me a favor? Would you edit the first chapter? And let me see what it looks like and see if I might be able to do it myself. But it brought up so many childhood fears about, you know, somebody's going to rip the guts out of what's really, you know, important to me, and maybe she's going to ridicule it and she's going to take out the heart of what I've written. And I remember her sending me back the first chapter and the introduction edited. And, you know, I knew what it was in the envelope, and I thought, well, I'm going to go over the road to where I live, I'm going to have a coffee, and I'm going to start reading it through, and if she's butchered it, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I remember getting out of the envelope and starting to read it, and I thought, I don't know what she's done to it, but she's taken my rough diamond and she's honed it into a, you know, into a shining diamond. I don't know what she's done, maybe I'll never understand, but she has really helped me.
And that's wonderful.
I really learned something about, firstly, about trust, and secondly, as you say, about cooperation, and realizing that in any creative endeavor, you know, you can do your part of it, but, you know, especially with writing, you know, a good editor can add dimensions that you'll never be able to do yourself.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and I actually believe that we weren't supposed to do anything alone. It's almost that thing, you know, about the animals going in the ark two by two.
Yeah,
it's like,
no, I think
you're
right.
We weren't supposed to do anything alone. We are, and you know, even like Jesus' words, you know, when two or more are joined together.
Yeah.
There is something very powerful that I've had to learn about that.
Yeah, no, I remember we had in the Alternatives team once, we had a woman called Bola, and she was from Africa. And I remember her saying, you know, in Africa where she came from, nobody was allowed to do anything on their own. Nobody was allowed to, you know. Not that it wasn't allowed, it was like, you know, everything needs to be shared. So even if they were going to collect water, you know, they'd send two people to do it because they didn't want anybody to be on their own. So, you know, I think you're totally right in what you're saying.
Such wisdom's come out of there. What, you know, it's amazing. It always does amaze me whenever I get lovely, interesting guests like yourself. The time has just flown. You know, we're almost coming up to sort of 10:02. I wonder if you could maybe tell us a bit about what you're doing today and where people can contact you or, you know, get a lot of your stuff, you know.
Well, I'm still a trustee of Alternatives. I'm involved in that, so I'm still passionate about helping, you know, spirituality and awakening get out to as big an audience as possible. So we're looking to take alternatives kind of online and hopefully get a national and potentially a global audience now on the internet. So, you know, I'm very much involved in helping that move forward. And then in terms of my own work, yeah, I've now written 5 books. And I suppose because I've been on my own kind of spiritual journey now for 25 years and kind of active in it for about 20 years, and I've just 50 a few weeks ago, as you know, you know, a little bit of me thinks, well, maybe I've got a bit of wisdom now, you know. I was just reading Marianne Williamson's book on midlife.
It's like you didn't have any when you came in, yeah.
Well, maybe I did and I forgot it, but I'm just remembering some of it now.
Yeah.
I've just been reading Marianne's book on midlife. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called The Age of Miracles, A New Approach to Midlife. And if anyone's listening and is approaching kind of midlife, I think it's a wonderful book. And something she said in it, which just so struck a chord with me, she said, you know, she was on a spiritual path for 10 years. She said, you know, it takes 10 years for us really to understand what even spirituality is and what spiritual principles are. Then you spend another 10 years trying to wrestle your ego to the ground because it's trying to play havoc and stop you understanding it. Then you spend another 10 years trying to apply it, and then maybe you start to really have some wisdom. And I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm just beginning to touch that place where I've really got some wisdom now. But I love that idea. And Marianne says, you know, if anyone ever told you the spiritual path was easy, they've never been on it.
but that is so true. I mean, that is so true, you know.
So where I'm at now is, you know, I'm still very passionate about my own creativity, and I love writing articles, and I'm certainly embracing the kind of internet and producing free programs, you know, and I'll give you the website in a minute for my programs. You can download some free programs and using both text and audio and video just to kind of get inspiration and ideas out to as wide an audience as I can. And my particular passion has really been, I suppose, you know, the path that I've been on myself, which was to leave a well-paid job where a lot of my identity was tied up in that and face all my fears to follow my own heart. And now I've built, you know, a reasonably successful business around it for myself. You know, and I've given talks over the last 10 or 12 years in, I think, 13, 14 different countries and dozens of different cities. And I feel so blessed that I get to do what I do. I feel truly grateful. And I suppose what I'm doing now is I'm setting up an infrastructure, if you like, with my businesses whereby I can help people that want to kind of do what I've done over the last 15, 20 years in a way be their tour guide for that journey and show them how to connect with their own purpose and how to connect with the work that they were born to do and how to discover that. But also kind of, you know, point out the potholes and the obstacles that you're likely to face and the ego traps that you can fall into. And be a tour guide and show the way. So if anyone's interested, you know, if you want to get a free program about discovering the work you were born to do, if you go to inspired-entrepreneur.com, inspired-entrepreneur.com, you can download a free program called Discover the Work You Were Born to Do, and it's really the essence of what I talk about. You can get it for free, and you know, that's there. You know, partly I feel like I'm on a bit of a mission to help as many people as possible, but, you know, on a pure business level, I know the more people that get something for free, some of them will probably end up being clients and spending some money, so there's a business side to it as well. But there's also, you know, that pure, you know, I hope, pure generosity, which is, you know, I've benefited, I've learned so much, and I just want to share that with some other people.
Well, I think that's wonderful, Nick, because I think that's a major part of it is doing some, and I don't consider that to be sacrifice. A lot of people say, oh, that's sacrifice, but I don't believe that. I think it's that old word, isn't it, balance.
Mm.
You know, there's nothing wrong in, you know, making money and making good money and all the rest of it. And I think there's always a space for giving away for no exchange.
Yeah.
That was a big thing that I fought with, you know, all this concept that has to be an exchange. Well, the minute I give away, especially since I've become a student of the course, where I notice, where I absolutely know that when I'm giving, I'm the one receiving.
Yeah.
You know, so even if there's no sort of... So I think that's wonderful what you're doing there.
And
do you have an agent that helps you, Nick? You say you've spoken in sort of many countries around the world. Do you have somebody that does a booking for that? Or?
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, I actually ran a seminar 10 days ago for the first time. I actually felt ready to run it. And I called the seminar How to Get Going in the Personal Development Business because I coach a lot of people. I do a lot of one-to-one coaching and mentoring. And I realized that perhaps 50 or 60% of the people that came to me wanted to get going in the coaching or speaking or healing kind of businesses. And I thought, well, I'll share some of my own experience of being on both sides of the fence, both as a presenter and a workshop leader, and as a promoter, being involved with alternatives. And the really thing I struggled with was to give people a strategy for, you know, giving talks and workshops. Because when I look back, I realized that pretty much everything that I'd ever done in the last 10 or 12 years had come because of a connection that I'd made. Nothing had come to me cold. And it really got me rethinking about, you know, what it says in A Course in Miracles, which is, you know, God has a plan for us. And in a way, you know, instead of thinking, well, how can I get speaking opportunities, I guess the way that all my opportunities come to me is, you know, I just connect with people, you know, whether it's through a free product, whether it's through friendships, whether it's giving a talk somewhere, whether it's word of mouth by people that I've never even met or, you know, I'm not aware they're doing it. Everything has come through connection. You know, I've been to South Africa 6 times in the last 5 or 6 years, I think, and that all started off because a woman was in a bookstore in South Africa and my book, The Work We're Born to Do, fell off the shelf in front of her, apparently, and she read it and she contacted me and, you know, it opened up a whole world in South Africa for me, you know, and I love going down there. But, you know, was that in my business plan that Helen was going to go into a bookstore in South Africa, a book was going to fall off the shelf and she was going to invite me to South Africa? You know, I suppose part of me goes, you know, there's something I am in control of, but there's an awful lot I'm not in charge of, but I have to trust that there is a great force in charge.
I think that's the major thing, isn't it, to understand that. We have to take the steps once we get, to me, it's about, you know, listening, watching, you know, really being tuned in for leads and messages, and know that when we're on track, they'll come to us, and our part is to take the action in following them up.
Yeah, you know, and I think probably the bottom line I would say for anybody listening, and when I look back at what I've done, in a way it's just, in a way, just turning up to be your best self, you know, not as a role, but as a just being willing to be in service to life. And the more that you turn up and be willing to be in service to life, the more the connections get made and the more the opportunities start showing up in your life. But, you know, I think when I started off, I thought, well, when the opportunities turn up, then I'll turn up. But I realized I had to turn up to create the opportunities.
Yeah, that's so important. Well, Nick, we're almost out of time, and it's been absolutely fantastic connecting with you again on a personal level, because I really enjoyed, you know, I know we did you did something down in Brighton, I spoke.
I really
connected, and it's been fantastic having you on the show, because what I love, and especially that our listeners have had this opportunity to hear authenticity, and I want to acknowledge you and commend you for your incredible authenticity.
Oh, bless you.
What you see is what you get. You talk about warts and all, and I think that's a great gift to people, and I'm very grateful for you giving up your time and coming on the show tonight.
My pleasure.
And look forward to connecting with you, you know, on the circuit.
Yeah, and if anybody wants any specific help, you know, by all means, get the free product or email me direct. And, you know, if I can, I'm more than willing to help. You know, I've had so many people help me along the way. And if I can just give anybody a nudge, please do get in touch. I'd love to help.
That's wonderful. And the email address, Nick?
Easiest one would be Nick, N-I-C-K, @heartatwork.net. Heartatwork.net.
Okay, so that's Nick at heartatwork.net. That's fantastic. And your website?
Inspired-entrepreneur.com.
Right. Okay. That's fantastic. Nick, thanks so much for coming on tonight. It's been a real joy to have you, and I wish you well in all your endeavors.
Thank you very much, and thanks for doing such a wonderful show. I really appreciate you having me on. So God bless.
It's a pleasure.
And speak again.